वञ्चाकल्पतरुभ्यश्च कृपासिन्धुभ्यैव च पतितानां पवानेभ्यो वैष्णवेभ्यो नमो नमः। निखिलाश्रुतिमौलिरत्नमालदिति निराजितापदपङ्कजन्त हाजीमुक्तकुलैरुपश्यामनं परितस्त्वं हरिणं संश्रयामि। हेलोदुनितखीदया विश्वदया प्राण्मीलरामोदया शाश्वतशस्त्रविवादया रसादया चितार्पितोन्मादया शाश्वतभक्तिविनोदया समादया माधुर्यमार्यादया श्रीचैतन्यनिधिदया तवादया भूयाद्मन्दोदय अजानुलम्बिता भुजो कनकापदातु सांकीर्तनायकपितरो कमलायतकृष्ण विश्वाम्भरो दुयावरो जुगधर्मपालु वन्दे जगत्प्रियकरो करुणावतारो नीलम्बोदिततिसदासविरह क्षेपन्वितं बान्धवं श्रीमद्भागवती कथामधिरय सञ्जीवयं भातिय श्रीमद्भागवतं सदा सनायना आश्रुपायनाय पूजयं गोस्वामी प्रवरो गदाधर विभूर्भूयाद्मदेकगति रासघनमुहानमूर्तिं विचित्रकेलिमहोत्सवोल्लसितं राधाचरणाभिलोदितं रुचिराश्रिखण्डं हरिं वन्दे वृन्दावनेश्वरी तवैव पदारविन्दं प्रेमामृतैकमकरन्दरसोघपूर्णं हृद्यार्पिता मधुपतिस्मरतापमोग्रं निर्वापयत्परमशीतलमाश्रयामे। भक्त्या विहीनाय अपराधलक्षाय क्षिप्ताशाखमादितरङ्गमाध्ये कृपामयि त्वं शरणं प्रपानं वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दं वृन्दे नमस्ते चरणारविन्दं। श्री सच्चिदानन्द गौर हरि की जय। श्री श्री गौर नित्यानंद गौर गदाधर जी की जय। श्री हरि नाम प्रभु की जय। श्री श्री राधा मदन मोहन राधा गोविंद देव राधा गोपीनाथ जी की जय। श्री गौर भक्त वृंद की जय। गौर प्रेमानंद हरि हरि बोल। सो प्रणाम टू ऑल ऑफ यू। धन्यवाद फ्रॉम दिजोन इन फ्रांस। टुडे लास्ट डे हियर, टुमोरो ट्रैवलिंग टू स्विट्जरलैंड एंड वेरी हैप्पी टू सी यू ऑल। एज डॉक्टर रासा मेंशन, देयर आर some new faces, at least some new faces for her, maybe not for me, all of them, but still some new faces even for me. And even the old faces are ever new. So there is ever freshness in each one of our relationships. So each one of you is a new face, since Bhakti has unlimited new faces dawning upon us. So very happy to see the, to have the darshan of the Vaishnavas in this ever new, ever fresh way. Thank you for being present today and shower me with your friendship, trust and association. Very blessed, very fortunate, and hopefully we can engage in some seva, in some tadatmya sangha today, in some empathic connection in East Agosti. So as I told you, we are in France. Last day, we have been here for maybe 4 days, having some interesting discussions, as you may have seen, on topics like how important, which is the role of beliefs in order to have a devotional life. I mean, do we need beliefs, or beliefs is something actually that gets in the way of actual faith? And we talked about also the power of prayer. We talked about, what else? There are various topics. I don't want to go into details and bore you with the schedule of these days. A few hours ago, we had a very interesting meeting with a Sufi teacher that was arranged by Uddhav Prabhu, the local devotee who invited us here. So we have some interesting conversation with him and his followers. We're invited to their ashram, basically. So just, yeah, coming from there a few hours back, and tomorrow heading to Anandadham, or the area of Anandadham, more precisely in my case, in Switzerland, where I will be staying like, yeah, almost a month there. some writing retreat will be there. So also requesting, doing Madhukari and praying for your blessings. So whatever the writing retreat is meant to manifest, that may be manifest, especially in terms of the next book that I have in mind, that you may know, that is in relation to the topic of unconditional love and how we are being unconditionally loved by Krishna and all the implications of that, and what gets in the way of that in the form of guilt and shame, and how to culture a healthy form of self-love in bhakti. So that's part of the project for the next 3 weeks, where I'll be a little bit hiding in between the Alps, so to say. Of course, I'll try. We will be connecting every week for our weekly Stagosti. That will be there. But apart from that, yeah, I'll be mostly offline, so to say. So your blessings in that journey, in that chapter also. And well, as usual, you are all welcome to share any, whatever you may like to bring to the table today, so we can have a feast together. But for having a feast, you need to bring something to the table in the form of questions or thoughts, comments, reflections, any form of sincere sharing of hearts. That will be welcome, and that will be part of the feast that will be nourishing us today. So I see two digital hands raised already, so we can begin there. First one is from Jugal Kishore. So we will go there first. You can unmute yourself, Jugal Kishore.
Hare Krishna, Maharaj. Hare Krishna, everybody. I'm tempted to defer to Rasangi because she always has such delectable questions.
We'll go to her, no problem. She's second in the queue, so she's there.
And I'm also tempted to simply ask you about meeting this Sufi master. Can you tell us something about that?
That will be your only question for today. So that's
okay. That's it then.
I'm joking, but yeah, I didn't know him. He's from a particular tradition. Let me see if I can recall the name of the teacher now. Rene Guenon. So Uddhav Prabhu organized the meeting. We didn't know too much till we were there what was going to happen. So that was also interesting, a good dose of mystery and uncertainty. We just knew that we were invited to meet with them. We had an hour and a half, and that they were preparing something for us to eat also. All that was the certainty part of the meeting. Everything else was out of our control, so that was good. So yeah, we had an interaction briefly, in one sense. From my side, I was mostly interested in listening to them and to him, the particular main, like, successor acharya, so to say, of this particular lineage. So he was explaining to us their particular doctrine, Sufi doctrine, which somehow is quite connected with Advaita Vedanta. So that was an interesting interaction, because of course we do not subscribe to Advaita Vedanta, but at the same time, that doesn't mean that we cannot have a conversation, of course. So, and recently, as some of you may know, I had a podcast recorded with a friend of mine who is subscribed to Advaita Vedanta. And we had a very interesting conversation, and he shared with me a very interesting perspective on Advaita Vedanta that he told me, probably mostly my lineage will disagree with me. So that was interesting. I won't say more than that. You will see it soon. So it was a nice dynamics to appreciate those differences. And of course, many points in common when at one point they started speaking about Dharma and Sanatan Dharma and the meaning of Om. And there was so much commonplace and how this world is conceived as an outpouring of divine love, and therefore is to be treated as a sacred reality. So back and forth, we have been talking like an hour and a half. Some other devotees were sharing perspectives and questions. We're talking about love, about relationality. It was most, again, us listening, but of course also we were able to share. He asked us also about our particular tradition, although I try not to be too much invasive, so to say, since we were being hosted by them. They invited us and they were happy to share their particular stance. So it was a nice back and forth. I mean, what I may take mostly from there myself is the importance of having, in my opinion, the capacity of having conversations with people we especially know we will disagree Some important points, maybe. And even in the context of that, we can find commonalities and points of agreement and points of connection without me trying to convince him or her or defeat them in argument or try to prove they are wrong and trying to show the supremacy of my own tradition, all this type of impulses that may come from a more insecure place, so to say. But yeah, many times that has to do a lot with insecurity, you know, when we need to convince others to prove ourselves better than others, to defeat others. Many times it doesn't come from a place of strong faith, but it comes from a place of weakness and fragility and insecurity when I need everyone else to agree with me. When someone disagrees, I start to become nervous and I don't know what to do and how to coexist with diversity, which is a tragedy. So anyhow, that's what I will mostly highlight from the whole meeting, but in general, it was very interesting closing to the visit. So thank you for your daily question, Yugal Kishore. If we have more time, we will invite you to raise your hand again. Let's see. So now, Rasangi, please.
Dandavat Pranams Maharaj. I just wanted you to meet Manjwali. She's my dear god sister.
Yeah. I know her. Of course,
you
I know
her.
We had a whole video call the other day together.
Oh, good. I'm so happy. I'm so happy to see her here.
Last month.
I love her dearly. She's a Pujari par excellence and an educator and wise woman. So,
yeah. And she will probably be visiting us in the UK. And I'm saying that out in the light, so I'm committing her by force.
Oh my God, I love it so much. Thank you. And I also want to thank you. My friend and I were downtown last night and we met a couple of Christians who wanted to bless us and help us heal. I was walking with my trekking poles and she thought I was in pain. So they came to do a blessing and we had a great conversation. You know, sometimes in the past, it would have been just avoid them. Like, don't even start, like, because you can't convince them or there's no reason. But thanks to you and your open-mindedness and your broad spectrum of connection, we were able to have a great conversation. And they really appreciated what we said. And it was just so delightful. Instead of running away or just shunning them or shining them on, we were able to discuss and share and stand up when when things were said that we did not agree with. And it felt so good. So thank you for that. And then my question is, in the scheme of things, like there's so much going on all the time, bombarded with issues and things. We get 85,000 thoughts a day coming in our mind. What is most important to focus on? What does Krishna care about here? What does Krishna care about? I don't think he cares about the Olympics or these other things going on necessarily. What is it that he does care about and that we can focus on to please him?
Okay. Don't say too loudly about the Olympics that we are in France here. They may hear you.
I know. I love it. Are you finding it in your energy field?
No, I don't. We are 3 hours from Paris, so it doesn't get so close to our magnetic environment. But yeah, probably something is there.
And then I'm enjoying the Olympics myself. I'm just being honest.
Okay. Thank you for your honesty.
I'm not putting it down, but I'm just asking, what is Christian focus on?
First of all, I appreciate what you mentioned first about meeting some Christians recently and they blessing you and some others. And I was thinking about the other day I was reading, recently I finished, quote unquote, finished reading a book of poetry by Rumi that was given recently to me by Pranada. I mean, she had it in her house in Alachua a few months ago when I stayed at their home with her husband Nagaraj, and I saw Rumi and said, wow, let's see. And so I started and I ended up asking, can I bring the book with me, please? Yes. So I have been ruminating a lot on Rumi. And in this connection, there's one line that came to my mind in connection to what you mentioned about being blessed by other people, even people from other traditions. And he will say, a beautiful short line, he will say, we need more grace than what we think. That's powerful, right? It kind of sent me into a very, when I read it first time, it's very simple, but it's right to the core, to the fabric of existence. We need more grace than what we think. No? So never underestimate your need of grace, so to say. So my point with this is, if I need more grace than what I think, I will be willing and open to be blessed by everyone and anyone. That's my point. If I am really a beggar of mercy, a thirsty beggar, I mean, I won't be discriminating like, oh, I only want grace coming from this particular background, and I won't become an elitist of grace. No, that doesn't make sense. It's an oxymoron to say elitist of grace. That's canceling what actual grace is about. So the real sincere soul who gets to this point of realizing, yeah, I need more grace than what I think, than what I say, I'll remain open to further expressions of that. It's not that grace is not coming already. That's also the classical point. It's like, because we were talking with this, with the friend of mine a few weeks ago, we gave a conference, and with Jeffrey Long, and we were talking about the relationship between grace and effort. Many times this question comes. So if I make an effort, grace comes. Is that type of transactional dynamics? Like, I made the effort and then grace comes. And if I don't make effort, sorry, no grace for you. Or by its very nature, grace is so gracious, so graceful, that it's always there, but we are not perceiving it. And by us making a sincere effort, we will access that grace that is already there. And of course, we agreed more on this stance. No, grace is always there. Full grace, ever-evolving mercies, already flooding every atom around us, but we are looking into another direction. So making a sincere effort in sadhana and bhajan is a way of accessing that thing that is already there. So I'm saying that just to make the point that, okay, I need more grace than what I think, but it doesn't mean that the grace is not there. But sometimes when someone comes and bless me, it takes me to this awareness of, oh, the blessings are there, are totally available. So anyhow, just a little thought in connection to your first comment, which it was not the question actually, but somehow it's related. And how it's related, as you may imagine.
What I meant, Maharaj, was in the past, I might have just not even bothered to stop and chat. I would have just thought, and I'm so grateful that I feel strong enough and clear enough in my own heart and open enough to embrace others, more diversity.
And again, when I was saying what I said, it's not to downplay or to criticize someone who in certain stage may need to be a little bit more sectarian, so to say, as we talked many times. You know, in the beginning of our journey, we may need to be a little bit more, okay, only my group, let's put the fence. Everything else may confuse us, but it's not so much about them being bad, but me not being capable enough of dealing with that diversity and appreciating the essence of that. So it's just my own lack of capacity rather than their evil intentions, so to say. So again, it's part of the journey, because if not, also we may become, okay, now I realize that I can take lesson from everyone, and those who are not open to that are this, and I continue to be fundamentalist in another way. This is the fall. So yeah. So anyhow, in connection to your question, what Krishna most wants from us, if I understood it correctly, if we have to be kind of reductionistic, so to say, like to boil down everything to one single thing, so to say, because as you say, there are so many considerations, 85,000 thoughts a day. Wow. And probably the interesting thing is that the sad thing is that maybe of those 85,000 thoughts, probably at least half of them are all the same. So we think the same thought repeatedly over and over again, no? Which is close to a definition of madness, but there we are. No, like the mind generally goes to very usual visited places and goes over and over again into very similar repetitive catatonic loops of many times useless thoughts. So that's important. I mean, mantra means that. Mantra means redeem your mind. You know, take your mind somewhere else. Like Jesus Christ's first word in his ministry was metanoias, you know. And metanoia means change your mind. Unfortunately, it was translated as repent. So it got a whole different connotation. But the very idea is like, don't send your mind into those well-known 85,000 useless thoughts that you have on a daily basis, which are almost all the same. So I will say, if we have to be very reductionistic, so to say, and just say one single thing, what comes to mind naturally to me is like the most important instruction of Krishna in the Bhagavad Gita, which is this verse that he repeats almost exactly in the same way twice. At the end of chapter 9, which in one way, chapter 9 is the most important chapter of the Bhagavad Gita in one sense. In one sense, every chapter can be the most important. But chapter 9, Rajaguhya Yoga, is many times considered the most important, depicting Bhakti as the king of all secrets and knowledge. So the last verse, verse 34, there's this verse that is repeated almost exactly in the same way at the very conclusion of the Bhagavad Gita, chapter 18, verse 65. For those shloka nerds, I'm sharing the numbers. And I see Jugal Kishore taking notes like a good nerd. Good. I'm one of those, so no problem. So in this verse, Krishna is saying, and the very first two words are basically the main thing, manmana. Manmana bhava mad bhakto mad yahi mam namashkuru mam devaisasi satyam te pratiyane priyosime or maya vaisasi atmai bam atmana mad parayana. Depending, there's a slight difference in the last line. But the beginning is the same. And Krishna begins saying, manmana. No, mana means our mind, and man means to me. So your mind to me. So give me your mind. Give me your whole attention. And that connects for me, of course, with the famous idea, smartavya satatam vishnur, vishmartavya najatu chit, sarvibhidis niseda sureta yorivakinkara. Always think about Krishna, never forget about Krishna. All rules and regulations are to serve this principle. And of course, how we can always think about Krishna, as I tried to mention in radical personalism, it's not like a mechanical exercise. Like, okay, peacock feather, blue sham color, pitambara, yellow cloth, bamboo flute, crooked in three parts, Vrindavan. I mean, we can do that visualization. It's totally fine. But it's not only that. It's not just that means to think about Krishna. But actually, the idea is the implications always think of me is fall in love with me. You can. That's the only way you can always think about someone. Even if I put a gun on your head and I say always think about whatever, you won't be able to do it. Even if I'm threatening you to die about it, and I put some type of sensor in your head that shows what you are thinking about, let's put it that way, and you are about to be killed, always think about an apple, or always think about Krishna. I mean, difficult to think about Krishna with a gun here, of course. But if we are not in love with someone or with that particular person, it's not possible to enter into that uninterrupted stream. So the implication with Krishna saying, always think about me, and that's what he says in chapter 12 also, when he says, always think of me. And then he says, if you cannot do this, then do this. And if you cannot do this, then do this. And so on and so forth. He starts to take the bar down and down to show his mercy. Like say, okay, let's begin somewhere. But the first option I gave you is showing where all this should converge. No? So you cannot do this, okay, follow the rules and regulations, act without attachment for your work, cultivate knowledge, whatever the other options are. Ultimately, all this should converge in. Love me. Give me your heart. Now, because again, Krishna is, as we mentioned before, we should be thirsty for mercy. It's not that Krishna is an exception to that rule. As paradoxical as that may sound, God himself is thirsty for mercy and love, and way more than us, I must say. That's why he's God. He's leading the way. Whatever a great person does, one should follow, says the Gita. So Krishna is a beggar of love, if we have to describe him poetically. No, like Srila Bhaktivinoda Dev Goswami Maharaj will speak about the loving search for the lost servant. So that's one side, no, like Krishna looking for us, but also, of course, us looking for him. So he's thirsty for love. The nature of love, as we talk many times, is that it gives total fulfillment, but it creates its own necessity of more love. Love cannot have an opposite. When you have prem or divine love, that prem cannot express itself into the opposite of that. At that point, love has no opposite. It can only become more of what it is. So Krishna is love himself. The Upanishad say, Raso Vaisaha. Raso Vaisaha Rasam Hiyavayam Ladhvanandi Bhavati. Now, God is Rasa. It's very loose to translate rasa as love. And also because we were talking today with the devotees, the word love is the most used word and the most misused word. Because we end up saying, I love Krishna, I love chocolate, I love the Olympics, I love my dog, I love my car. And it's the same word for chocolate and for our istadev. So that's not the idea, of course. So it's dangerous that we reduce all that to this word without further clarifying. But anyhow, I'm running a risk here. So Krishna says, Raso Vaisaha. I mean, the scriptures say, he, the absolute, supreme absolute, is love himself. The highest form of condensed ecstatic emotion called rasa, he is that. So he's made of that. It's difficult to imagine a person made of divine sacred love. So in his composition, in his constitution, in his nature, he's constantly thirsting for more of that of what he is. So these are very unique theological ideas. So only to one point we can capture that in our heads. Our heads that have 85,000 useless thoughts a day. And suddenly entering into this world where God, a God made of love, is thirsty for more of what he is and discovering newer and newer layers of that. But that's the point. Now, Krishna is a needy God in the good sense of the term, needy not as something bad, but he's in great necessity because love satisfies all needs and creates its own needs in the form of further love. Prem prayojan. Prayojan means the ultimate goal. Prem or prayojan also means necessity. So prem is the ultimate necessity, but prem creates the ultimate necessity in the form of more prem and more prem. So therefore, again, Krishna is desperate for love. And our role ultimately is to give our life fully to quench that thirst, basically. To quench that thirst. That's a unique prospect that Gaudiya Vaishnavism gives. As I like to say sometimes, and I know it may sound a little shocking for some, but in the dynamics, for example, of the Leela, in Vrindavan, Golok, Radha and Krishna, on the daily Leela, they are getting together, getting separated, together, separated, union, separation, union. That's the ongoing dynamics in the Leela. In separation, they will feel like there's one stage of separation. The 10th state of separation is mriti, which means death. This doesn't mean that Radha and Krishna die, literally. That never happens, fortunately. But they feel like dying. There's a point where the separation rises to such a stage, first stage, second, 10th, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10, that unless and until they get together, they feel, I cannot take it anymore. I will die. And of course, they never die. They always get together just on time. But all the servants in the Leela just leave and are willing to live and to die for creating that reunion and saving the lives of Radha and Krishna on a daily basis. And that's the window of opportunity into which we are being invited for eternity. Our saving eternity somehow or other will be to save the life of God on a daily basis. Try to accommodate that one. That's the arrangement of Yoga Maya. That's the arrangement of Lila. Who we are? Nobody. No. Who am I? Nobody. But that's the arrangement of grace. No, and that's because that's the need. That's a divine necessity that exists in that upper realm. Those are the needs created by love. So, and we are invited to enter there. I mean, we will only be able to enter there if we are willing to serve the needs of love. That's nothing else to do there. No. That's what Srila Siddhar Maharaj will say once. Someone asked him, what's Prem? What's Prem? What's divine love? And he said, of course, he said many things. I'm going to one of the definitions. He said, Prem means that you are receiving an unlimited quantity of energy to offer in service. So you will be showered with an unthinkable amount of potency, but of course that's not for yourself to keep, to enjoy. It's to extend an offer in service because there's such an intense necessity in the Leela. So entering the Leela has a price to pay. That's no joke. No, it's not something cheap. Not to dismiss or to discourage people, just for us to have a realistic idea of what's going on there. And not just think like, I will go and dance and sing as I think I'm doing it, as I'm doing it here. But as many times poetically described in scripture, each one of the associates of Radha and Krishna is willing to die millions of times to facilitate the reunion. Or sometimes it is said that Vishakha Gopi is willing to die a million times with Jesus, see one drop of perspiration coming from Radha's face to relieve her of that, and whatever anxiety is creating that particular drop, she's willing to throw herself into endless deaths to just satisfy that particular need. So again, it may sound a little too much for us here, but that's the intensity of the ultimate reality. So all this to say, in reply to your question, Rasangi, that again, what we can offer to Krishna, to Radha and Krishna, Shishi Gaur Gadadhar, that's another whole conversation. Radha and Krishna in Gaur Lila, and the level of necessity that is there in Gaur Lila, that's still yet on another level. But that will be another conversation. So we can offer ourselves in divine love to them. We can become ourselves, allow ourselves to become imbued with bhakti, to open our hearts to be invaded by bhakti samskars, by devotional impressions, to spiritualize our whole being tip to toe. So from that place, from that empowered place, empowered by bhakti, we can offer something that may quench the thirst of the absolute, an absolute who is thirsty for love eternally. That's a game. That's the nature of love. That's the arrangement in the Leela. That's what keeps the Leela going on. Basically, because externally we'll see in the Leela, it seems that they are doing basically the same thing every day at the same time. So it may sound like a little boring to go to a place for eternity with every time they do something relatively similar. And even if that's the case externally, internally, there's always, again, newness and freshness and new necessities, new depths of love that are required. So that's what keeps the Leela going. That's what keeps the Leela a success, basically. If we want success, well, we know which is the invitation. So it's a gradual process. Again, it's a gradual process. And one last thought in relation to this idea of all we think of Krishna. Again, it's not just a mechanical visualization, but trying to remain in the presence of God at every step. That's basically I will say in our stage, all we think of God. It's not just like a mechanical mental visualization. That can happen. But also to perceive his presence, their presence at every moment, at every step, in every situation and life circumstances, to internally connect and see whatever it's outside or inside, connect that with our object of meditation, our object of love. So that's for me even more realistic in terms of always think of Krishna and always remaining present to their presence, to Radha Krishna's presence. No? Because they are already present, right? They are omnipresent. There's not a place they are not. But where are we? That's the actual question. And so in big part of our practice is to bring presence to the table, right? It's as we were talking, I think last night, we had kirtan and some gathering, and at one point we talked about prayer and prayer as an act of presence. Like it's a statement, like trying to become ourselves present to them. Radha and Krishna, they're already present. No, we don't need to call them. Hey, come here, please. Here I am. They're already there. Even before you dare to call them, they're already there. Even before you know that they exist, they're already there. Closest than the closest, most intimate than the most intimate thing. That's a paradox. No, they are so close that we don't perceive them sometimes. No. Now, the divine is so close to us that we lose sight of them. It's too close. So yeah, prayer is an act of presence. So it's not about bringing their presence. They're already present. It's about me being present to their presence. So trying to, yeah, more and more enter into that space and live our lives from that place. Anyhow, some thoughts. Sorry if I overextended, but it's an exciting topic, as you can imagine.
Thank you, Maharaj. And
does it make sense?
I think that there's nothing more yummy to me or endearing that the fact that Krishna is needy for love, that he needs. Oh, that just is so amazingly juicy and wonderful. He actually wants and needs our love. I love that. Mm. And the other thing is, I saw a quote recently. If you want to show that God is love, be love. Show God of love through your own love, right? Mm-hmm. How else can we teach that or share that unless we become loving, I guess? So thank you. That was a great answer.
Thank you. That was a great question.
Okay,
let's continue. We have a few more hands raised. So Sherry, next one. You can unmute yourself.
Dhanyavads, pranams. So good to be here with all of you. Prasangi, I'm so thankful for your question. The answer to that question was something I wanted to reflect on before the question was even asked or the answer was given. And I did have a small question too. I think a big realization for me in the past month, especially, is that I am already loved, that God is there. And I don't have to do anything but love him back. And I had really lost that. You know, I grew up Catholic. And, you know, there was a lot of black and white thinking with heaven, hell, purgatory, all that stuff. But there also was this thread running through it that you, like, the worse you were, the more God loved you. You know, there was that always, you know, there's the lost sheep. Mm-hmm. And, you know, those lost sheep are so special to God, right? Because he wants you even more. Mm. And so I always kind of had a feeling like even when I was at my worst, troubled youth or past, you know, God still loves me. Like it would still be in my head. God still loves me. No matter what I do, I'm still loved. And I think when many years ago when I started in bhakti and I was learning, you know, I obviously love the essence, but I became very caught up in the externals. And am I doing this right? Am I doing that right? Oh, I'm doing it wrong. And I found myself literally apologizing to God over and over again, like, oh God, I'm so sorry, Krishna. I'm so sorry, Krishna. I must be the worst devotee ever. I keep screwing this up, you know, and it became so much about that external that I really, you know, lost that deeper connection. And I felt like a failure many times, much of the time. And I'm just now beginning to come to this place of acceptance again. You know, when I was chanting the other night, I was just sending love to Krishna. And I felt the love coming back in a way that I haven't felt for so long. And I feel like I'm starting to trust my heart again, where for many years I feel like I just abandoned myself, thinking I wasn't even good enough for God. So I love the talk about God is thirsty for love, and that, Krishna is having this loving search for his lost servant, because it reminds me so much of the lost sheep of the flock. And I guess, that was just sort of my realization I wanted to share, and how I feel so re-energized in my melting heart for the love that I just somehow had forgotten, in my self-abandonment. And I guess my question, it's not a very intellectual question, but I'm kind of curious about association of devotees. Lately, the past 6 months or so, I've really my nature is that of a hermit. So I always, and growing up again with the Catholic stuff, I really looked up to the monks, the hermitage, the solitude. And I see how, especially reading Merton's Contemplation in Action, it has to be an active thing, and that makes me think of Sangha, association. And I guess right now I've been having so many issues at temple, and I've come to a place where I've kind of stepped away, and I am trying to figure out association, because I know this is so valuable, this association, and I thank Krishna I found this. But I also used to have weekly association with my Sangha, my Delaware Sangha, and I've lost that. And I know association is such an important part of bhakti, stated by Prabhupada. And I feel I'm still associating, like in online sanghas, but I'm not getting the in-person sangha. And my nature right now, especially, is one of isolation. I just want to be reading, chanting, doing sadhana, painting pictures. Like, I feel very quiet. And again, maybe I'm just getting caught up in an external, but I think I'm also feeling the loss of my in-person sangha. And I feel very, I don't want to lose sangha. I don't want to lose association. So, I guess my question is, what's the best thing for a person to do, who maybe has this nature and who maybe is not having like in-person sangha? Many of us, I can't, many of us aren't close to temples anyway, but I guess that was my question. Thank you.
Oh, thank you. And of course, you are not alone in this, Sherry. Many of the things you are sharing are very, very common patterns of the journey. So it's important that also we learn to share our chapters, although each journey is unique at the same time, but there's so much commonality in what we are challenges that we go through and situations of loss and renewal and bewilderment and so on and so forth. First of all, thank you for your words and your appreciation for, how to say, the new life that you are feeling that is coming through the notion of returning to this place of acknowledging Krishna's unconditional love. I think that's a very important point. That's what I say. I'm planning to write a whole book about it because I think it's important to make a point. Let's write a book about it, you know, to make the case a little bit more strong. So, and the need to, yeah, to rest in that place, which is not easy, which requires so much surrender in terms of Krishna's already loving me and I haven't done anything to deserve it. And still that's there. That's such a bitter pill to swallow for the false self that wants to perform, that is a human doing and not a human being, that wants to deserve, that wants to impress, that wants to earn, that wants to fit in. And Krishna's unconditional love says, you already belong. You don't need to fit in. You already belong. I love you unconditionally. You haven't done anything to deserve it. That's so humbling. That's the death of the false ego, basically. If you properly get it, that's a blow to the false ego completely. So it's very important. So we can practice our bhakti from the right place, knowing ourselves to be loved and understanding my part in this relationship is to give the love back, basically, again, to reciprocate. The goal of life is not to get Krishna to love me, because that's already happening. It's like to say, okay, the goal of my day is that the sun shines. No, that's already happening. You just have to go out and see the sun shining, that you have to expose yourself to that light. And then you can wonder, okay, may I do something to express my gratitude to the sun? No, how can I reciprocate for this favor? So again, the goal of life is not love from Krishna, as I like to say. Goal of life is love for Krishna. Because love from Krishna is a given from time without beginning. But we need to become ingrained in that reality. It's not an idea, it's a reality. It's already happening. And from that place, practice bhakti. Again, not trying to make him love me, make him not be so angry at me, convince him I'm not so imperfect, I'm not so such a failure, such a mess. No need to convince him. Krishna will say, you don't need to convince me that you are not a mess. You're still a mess, and I love you. No, that's how Krishna will reply. Now, why you are going neurotic about performing superficially perfection? I don't care for perfection. I care for the sincerity of your presentation. No, sincerity of your heart's presentation. That's what I'm thirsty for, going back to the thirsty idea. That's it. That's it. And I love you even when you're failing miserably in the worst possible case. So that's Krishna will say, don't make me feel awkward. No, don't try to to convince me that you are not so bad and to be perfect. That feels weird. I don't like that relationship. That's we cannot have a relationship like that. Like I won't like to have, he will say. So yeah, basically he wants us to be normal. No, we are so weird generally. No, we approach God with the most weird thoughts, and we project on him many times the greatest weirdness. And Krishna is so patient and compassionate, seeing like, you are thinking that I am such a weird guy and I think like this and I will do this to you. You have such a long idea, a whole bunch of dysfunctional notions about me, but I still love you unconditionally. Okay, no problem. Let's wait a little bit more. It's happening. So when we realize all that and we see how much we are being already loved and already accepted despite everything, naturally our life of bhakti and practice, it becomes different, totally differently oriented. Now, again, we are not practicing to try to convince him of earn this and so on, but we want to give back. We want to give something back. We want to return the embrace somehow or other. We want to like you were saying, we're chanting, no? Instead of chanting to Krishna, please love me, please like me, please accept me, we can chant for his pleasure. No, I remember once I say that, and yes, some devotee was like shocked by the idea. Like I never thought about that such a thing will be possible. No, I can chant for to give pleasure to Krishna. Okay, yeah, to give something back. No, we don't need to ask so much because we already have the most important thing from the most important person. We have love from God. The most important thing, love from the most important person, God. That's already a given. So what else do you want to request, so to say? Especially when you are addressing that particular person who is giving you the most important thing. So ideally, yeah, it's important that we offer ourselves for his, her, their pleasure, especially understanding what we mentioned, they are in such a divine necessity out of the arrangement of divine love. So that's it, going to your question. Sadhu Sangha, 3D Sadhu Sangha, three-dimensional Sadhu Sangha. And the loss of that, because sometimes that's another part of the whole story. Okay, we may have had Sadhu Sangha in certain group of community, and for whatever reason, we have lost that community. I can hear you. I know what that's how that feels like. And sometimes an aspect, I will say something that comes in this moment, is probably one of the best things we can do when we lose a community, when we lose Sadhu Sangha, and we don't want that to happen. We don't want to be deprived of that, but we have lost that, and that's pretty recently. We need to spend some time grieving our loss, and staying with that grieving. And in that grieving, what we have lost, we are like recuperating that in a new form. It may not happen immediately, but by grieving what we have lost, that warranties that we have not lost anything, but actually we are acquiring a more upgraded version of that thing that we have lost. Whatever that form that may take, whenever that may happen, that may take some time, of course. But I think that's a proper way to, because if we grip something, it means that thing was important to us, of course. Now, if it was unimportant, I'm not grieving. But if I'm grieving, it meant something to me. So it's an acknowledgement of the significance of that particular association. And for whatever reason, of course, if we can try to recover that, if that's necessary and healthy, that's one thing. But if for whatever reason we know that's not happening and that shouldn't be happening, still we can grieve, and still we can honor that, be grateful for that, long for that. And I was saying that grieving with proper longing and appreciation will gradually attract, again, a more profound, necessary version of that in our lives, in one form or another. And again, I know that online gatherings like this are not the same as in person. I don't want here to make a case to replace three-dimensional meetings. That's uttam uttam, that's the highest. But sometimes, again, love moves in a crooked way, and Krishna's arrangements in our life will take different shapes. So we should be willing not to be too like attached to, okay, things looking in certain way at every step of my journey. So in certain step of my journey, the best thing I may receive is online sangha, and that's the perfect sangha I need for that particular moment. It doesn't mean it will be forever like that, but it may be the best possible thing I need at this chapter. And I'm not saying, and we are that for you now. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying it may be, it may be not. You have to decide that, but we have to be open, no? To how these things manifest. It may take one shape, it may take another shape. Sometimes we may not have, for example, I recall Srila Bhakti Pragyan Keshab Maharaj, disciple of Prabhupada Bhaktisiddhanta. He will write this article called Shastriya Sadhu Sangha. At the time when there was no Zoom, right? So there was no possibility of online gathering. So he will say, if you don't have the chance of having in-person Sadhu Sangha, you can have Shastriya Sadhu Sangha. So have Sadhu Sangha through the scriptures. By studying the scripture, the words of the masters, the words of the different sadhus, sadhvis, you are associating with that person also. If you are open and sincere enough, you are having the company of those living teachings, teachers and teachings. So that's also a way of sadhu sangha. I'm not saying that, okay, you take that as a perfect excuse, so you no longer have to deal with in-person stuff. I'm not saying that, but I'm saying in certain circumstances, that may be an option, and online sadhu sangha may be a complement to that, and we may find different elements that provide in complement what we need in this particular chapter, and in time some further arrangement may be done. Again, we began talking about Krishna loving us unconditionally. So if I sincerely long for sadhu sangha, I mean, Krishna won't oppose that, right? I mean, he sincerely longs for sadhu sangha himself. Now, I won't torture you with all the verses of what Krishna says about the sadhus, who the sadhus are for him. No, sadhavam hridayam mahyam sadhunam hridayam tuham. Only one, only that one. Chapter 9th canto of the Bhagavatam. Krishna says, the sadhus are my heart, I'm their hearts. No. So I cannot think of anything apart from them. They cannot think of anything apart from me. I'm basically, we are lost in love with each other. So if someone, I mean, Krishna is so in love with the sadhus, if someone says, I want sadhu sangha, I mean, that's the thing, that's the wish Krishna will most urgently fulfill in one way or another. So my point is, if we know Krishna loves us unconditionally, and on the other side, we really don't want to lose sadhusanga, there is no point thinking that such a thing could ever happen. So we should also reach that place of certainty in that sense, of confidence, like, that will never happen. Krishna will protect me. Krishna is maintaining me. Again, these are the central aspects of saranagati, of surrender. Rakshishatiti bishva sogop tritvivaranam. To trust that Krishna will protect me, to trust that Krishna is maintaining me, accepting. And he protects us and maintains us through sadhusanga. That's one way to put it. So in one sense, that's already happening. So in one sense, we shouldn't even be afraid of, may I lose sadhusanga? Because if I pay close attention, I will realize how Krishna is already providing me beautiful sadhusanga in my life. So he himself is replying to my fear of not having sadhusanga by giving me sadhusanga. So I don't know if that helps at all, Sherry. Does it make sense?
Thank you, Maharaj. Yeah, that was very helpful. So helpful. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for your question. Okay, next digital upraised hand from Austria, Mayapur Sangha.
Hare Krishna Maharaj, this is Lakshmi Priya Dasi from Austria. Haribol. From Argentina, basically.
Yeah, I know you. Yes, yeah.
Nice. Yes. Haribol. My pranams, Maharaj. My pranams to all the Vaishnavas and Vaishnavis online. Maharaj, I have a question regarding grace that you were talking at the beginning of the Ishta Goshti. And also a little bit in connection to what Sherry said right now. I'm going also through a kind of a period where I decided myself to kind of separate a little bit from my own community or environment, because I started to notice, or what I have learned all through the years was that this grace is only achieved through suffering. And I wanted to ask you where this concept of suffering in connection to grace comes from. Mm-hmm. Because I also see it like you are mentioning right now, like we are afraid of losing Sangha, but Krishna answers with more Sangha. So in my opinion, for example, grace, already that we are talking all together about Krishna, that's already Krishna's grace, basically, for me. Mm. I see and I read many texts where a lot of suffering is there in order to reach a level where we are qualified to achieve that grace. So mm-hmm. how to get rid of this mentality? Because for me, it became quite unhealthy and I cannot deal with that anymore.
Mm. Yeah. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Yeah. Yeah. Yesterday we were talking about suffering as well. It's a huge topic. And I think it's important that we talk about suffering more often and we understand more it. Suffering, what's suffering, what's the role of suffering, does it have a role, what to do with it? Because of course on one side I will say, of course, suffering is part of life. We are not here to deny it, but also we are not here like to promote, okay, the more you suffer, the more Krishna loves you, or the more advanced you are. We are not like masochists, like devotional masochists or something like that. But also we are not the suffering deniers, so to say. No, like, okay, just like harmony junkies. No? We just want everything to be harmony and peace and joy and beauty. No, there's suffering also. And that's part of life, and we need to know what to do with it. But that doesn't mean that we are trying to look for more and more and more and more suffering. Like, the more I suffer, the closer I'm to Krishna, or something like that. And so I think we need to balance the discussion and give suffering, pain, a place, no? But not necessarily just like making the ultimate priority, so to say. And again, when I'm saying pain and suffering, that's a word, but there are so many ways to speak about suffering. There are different degrees of suffering, as we were talking also yesterday. No? When you have divine love, there is suffering there. As we were saying yesterday, yesterday also, but a few minutes ago, when Sri Radha is in separation from Krishna, she suffers. She's not having a great time celebrating that she's about to die in separation of him. She's suffering. But she's not suffering as we are suffering now. That her suffering has nothing to do with our idea of suffering. We are using the same word, but the subjective experience are worlds apart. So that's the delicate thing when we use these words, as I say, for love. Okay, love, chocolate, love, Krishna, love, Olympics, love, whatever, suffering. And we hear suffering, and for us, suffering means something and triggers in us something. But the suffering that, I don't know, Sri Radha or a pure devotee is going through is absolutely different. It's full of, actually, it's full of ecstasy. It's paradoxical. Now, there, Srila Siddharmaraj will say that. There can be sweetness in suffering. It's possible. There is a sweet way to suffer. And actually, that's part of our idea. Not so much to stop suffering, because that won't happen. If we want to go to the Lila, there will be suffering in the Lila, as I'm describing, a type of suffering. Again, not the same suffering with it, but a type of suffering. So it's not about stopping to suffer. It's about learning to suffer. How to learn to suffer, how to crafting the art of suffering, so to say. Again, with this, I'm not saying let's talk about suffering all day. I'm just saying we have to be careful not to totally dismiss suffering, because if not, our practice just becomes an anxiolytic. I don't know if you have this word in English. Like these pills you take when you're anxiety and you just do something to calm down. So you will just see Krishna and sadhana and japa just as something to reduce your anxiety levels, and that's it. Not to suffer. But again, Bhagavad Gita, first chapter of the Gita is Vishada Yoga, the yoga of despair. So immediately the Gita brings to the table suffering, Krishna's, Arjuna's condition, like saying, hey, guys, this happens in life. Let's not deny it. Let's not repress it. Let's confront it. Let's integrate it. Let's grow by that. Because when we suffer also, we are, as we were saying yesterday, our heart opens in pain. The heart is open in pain. Many times when we have too much pleasure and no suffering, too much pleasure, we become kind of numbed, no, instead of open and present and sensitive and vulnerable. So again, I don't want to sound my reply just, it's all about suffering. I just want to make the case that there is place for that. And as I think Karuneshwar is quoting, yeah, no, Bhadra is quoting this famous verse from Queen Kunti, tatra tatra jagat guru bhavato darshanam jatsyat apunar bhava darshanam, which is an important verse that we need to, at in the same level, to understand it correctly. No? Because if not, we can become very dysfunctional. Where Kunti is praying to Krishna for more problems. And she already had a good amount of them. Maybe she had more problems than anyone in the history of humanity. And she's asking for more. So one may think it seems that this lady has some problem. She's like addicted to suffering. But no, she's saying, I take it like she's asking for challenging situations. Now, for situations that put yourself to test so you can see where you are. That may create some discomfort, but that's also inviting me to grow into a new space. So that's how we take that verse. Not so much like, okay, you have to pray for Krishna for more suffering, for more problems, and he will send that. And again, which idea of God we develop by that? No. So Krishna loves us unconditionally. We at present suffer. Many times we don't suffer because of divine love. Many times we don't suffer because of genuine compassion by witnessing the condition of others, because that's suffering also, a legal one. But many times we suffer as a reaction of our own self-centeredness and so on and so forth, dualistic mentality and separatedness and selfishness, so many things. So suffering is coming to teach us a lesson, of course. No, it's a symptom that we are doing something that is creating that suffering. Again, not to bring a whip and chastise ourselves, but just to take responsibility. No. if I'm suffering, why I'm suffering? Let's not end the conversation and I'm suffering, how to stop suffering. But what's behind this? What the suffering is trying to tell me? So that's something, but of course, I wouldn't overemphasize. It's all about suffering. It's all about suffering. It's all about suffering. As we were talking before, there's lots of place to be happy, to be joyful, to be balanced, to lead a lifestyle that is sustainable, that we can pay attention to our material needs, even physically, mentally, emotionally. Less place to to practice bhakti. Krishna says in the Gita, Sushrukam Kartum, this bhakti had to be practiced with lots of joy. So, which again, can sound paradoxical with all that I say with suffering, but that one thing doesn't cancel the other. But you have to be able to practice bhakti with joy. Again, if we connect, okay, Krishna loves us so much, he's so merciful, so many gifts and grace are coming to my life. If you really stop for a minute and make a list of all the gifts that came to our life, you just want to celebrate. You just want to race and kijai, go to Haribol and roll on the ground for a while. So we have lots of reasons to celebrate. And we have also to be, as Krishna says in the Gita, yuktahara viharasya yuktachastasya karmasu. We have to be balanced in our yoga, in our practice of linking with the divine. He says you have to be balanced in sleeping, you have to be balanced in working, you have to be balanced in recreating yourself. Krishna is saying that in the Gita. What's recreation for one person is not recreation for the other person, of course. No, Bhishmaraj Chakravarti will say the yogi living in the cave, his recreation is to take a walk. I'm go back to the cave. Okay, that's his recreation, but everyone's recreation will take a different shape at different stages. But we have to find those balances. It's not that Krishna wants to see us suffering, wants to see us miserable. And he will, I don't know, kind of rejoicing in that, or like, okay, now I will help you because you are so miserable. That's not the God we worship. So that's what I could say. No, of course, there is place for pain. Pain is part of life. We don't need to cancel that. We just need to learn to learn from suffering. Pain wants to tell us something. It's coming to open our hearts. There is a healthy expression of pain through compassion, through divine love, through proper repentance also. Sometimes if I do something really wrong, I mistreat someone, I make someone feel bad, and I realize that it's okay that I feel pain. No, it's a symptom of sanity. No, I hurt you and I feel bad about it. That's good, right? It's not that I'm desiring that so you become full of guilt and shame, but there's a healthy expression of guilt and shame. Also, if we have no guilt and shame in any form, we can become a public danger because we have no filter. We do anything and everything. We become psychopath and we don't empathize with anything and everyone. So, so anyhow, there is place. Of course, I'm seeing further quotes that are being shared. Sorry if I cannot follow all the chats. What is Bhadra sharing? Happiness and distress. Yeah, Bhagavad Gita 2:14. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Sukha Dukha Agama Painyo Nityastam Stitiksha Shabharata. So happiness and distress come and go like the different seasons, of course. And of course, that section of the Gita refers to, so to say, material happiness and distress. But also, as I'm mentioning, even in divine life, there is a type of joy and a type of distress. But it's all in service. So I will say that if we are trying to be devotees of Krishna, we try to offer everything to Krishna. No, when we are in joy, we try to offer our joy for the pleasure of God. When we are suffering, we offer ourselves in that situation. It's not that we need to wait to be okay again before going to prayer. And also, it's not that like the more we suffer, Krishna will love us more. Also, that's an important thing. Of course, Krishna loves us when we are suffering, but it's not like, okay, when you suffer, I love you more. That will be conditional love, not unconditional. Unconditional means doesn't matter the condition. Doesn't matter you are fallen or fallen, suffering. Unconditional love is a fixed given, so to say. So So yeah, one needs to find a I'm not here to tell people which environment they should go or which sangha they should associate with, but I will say that we should find our place in a way that is sustainable for the stage we are in the practice, in our journey today. Nowadays, we should be surrounded by people that validate both things, in my opinion, people that validate pain and suffering, and also, like, of course, are not making a whole doctrine around pain and suffering, and you cannot be happy, but you have to suffer more and more. You should repent and feel remorseful and ashamed because of how bad you are, all these type of things, because it ends up becoming it can happen. We can end up weaponizing these ideas in the name of humility, in the name of surrender. Like, you are never good enough. You are so fallen. You are more fallen than what you think. So you should be feeling really bad, actually, about you and stuff like that. No, which is not healthy, of course, in my opinion. There's a place to feel bad about ourselves if we did something bad, but it has to be in a certain way, in a certain context, that still there is hope, still it's clear that we are loved by Krishna, but we are loved by Krishna's representatives, not only Krishna, because that's also strange. And if I tell you, hey, Krishna loves you, but all of us are treating you like crap. And I said, no, you are supposed to embody that unconditional love in my life, no, like, so that's sadhu sangha. No, sadhu sangha is a circle where people embodies Krishna's unconditional love. How does it look for me in 3D? So it's not enough to say Krishna loves you and I treat you in the opposite way. So we need to find some safe space where we can be vulnerable and we can be who we are and being loved and accepted for who we are. But at the same time, a healthy space that, again, invites us to learn to suffer, a healthy space that challenges us to change the things we need to change also, because if not, always the risks to become too, or too strict, so to say, or too complacent. I mean, we run so many risks in going too much to one extreme or the other. So the idea is always to keep the thing going in the middle path, so to say, which is the most difficult one, to keep things always in balance. So that's what's coming today. I don't know if that helps, Lakshmi.
Thank you so much, Maharaj. Yeah, it's very clear. Thank you.
Thank you. So what time is it now? 5:20. We have two more hands. Let's see if we can get to those two, at least to the first one. Let's see, Jugal Kishore. But Martina first, she's raising her hand. So if you want to unmute yourself, Martina from Belgium.
Yes. Hi, Maharaj. First of all, just wanted to tell you that I started to read Rumi today, selected poems.
What? Sorry?
You cannot hear me?
Yeah. But I didn't hear what you say. It's hard for you say something.
No. I started reading Rumi's selected poems today. So I was happy to hear that you were reading Rumi recently as well.
Okay.
Yeah. I mean, I was like, today when I started reading, honestly, I mean, tears just started coming out. It's so beautiful. I didn't expect that. I knew some of his poems before, and that's why I bought the book. But yeah, I think it's super sacred. Super sacred book. Okay. And my question is regarding the statement. I cannot give you a reference at the moment to some other statements, but I will give you the one that I read recently from Swami Sadananda, where he's saying that the Atma who has turned away from God believes he is the coverings. He is the coverings, and the coverings believe they are the Atma.
Okay.
The Atma who has...
Yeah,
and also the Atma who has turned away... I lost it. The Atma who has forgotten God receives an emotional and mental, intellectual and physical covering, which is perishable but real. So I just wanted to hear your thoughts, how to understand this, because these kind of statements, and I heard from other let's say, maybe I don't know, should I say the acharyas or other teachers, I heard many times that they're saying as soon as we turn away from Krishna, we are getting this physical body, or we are covered by Maya. So this implies that there was a beginning when we turned away from Krishna, right? I mean, I know that we...
Your main theme, Martina.
Yes, I know. I'm still there, Maharaj. I'm still there and still trying to understand. And every time when I read it, I'm like, because I'm trying to kind of connect how I see that, but also, you know, try to understand why other people are saying what they're saying.
Yeah.
Because for me, it doesn't make sense. And yeah, I just wanted to hear your thoughts. How to understand this? Because I was trying to understand it in a way like, okay, maybe I'm turning away from Krishna on a daily basis. But this is now, right? But these statements are more like, as soon as we turned away from Krishna, we got this body. So it implies that there was a beginning. So yeah, please, if you have some thoughts on that.
Okay. Yeah. We can say something, of course, but before, since you invoked Rumi, let me share with you one poem by Rumi,
okay.
I mean, that I quoted in Radical Personalism, so you can find it. That's how I begin chapter 2 of the book. That's page 13, which is it. Says like this. This being human is a guest house. Every morning a new arrival. A joy, a depression, a meanness, some momentary awareness comes as an unexpected visitor. Welcome and entertain them all, even if they are a crowd of sorrows who violently sweep your house empty of its furniture. Still, treat each guest honorably. He may be clearing you out for some new delight. The dark thought, the shame, the malice, meet them at the door laughing and invite them in. Be grateful for whatever comes, because each has been sent as a guide from beyond. Rumi Kija.
I know that one. Yeah, it's a beautiful one.
Yeah. Yeah. A challenging one, but a beautiful one. Like,
yes.
Everything challenging. So going to your question, I've talked about that a few times, and we have a big audience with us today, so I assume that probably part of the audience will have a different opinion than mine in relation to this topic. So just giving the in advance idea, in case you need to fasten your seatbelt, but it's totally fine. I have no problem in coexisting with differences of opinion. So according to my understanding of Shastra, and we have talked about this with Martina a few times and with some of you, the concept that Shastra gives in terms to we turning away from Krishna, falling into the material world, becoming conditioned, and so on, the term in Shastra is anadi karma. So anadi karma means karma that is anadi. Anadi means without beginning. No, adi means beginning, anadi means without beginning. So anadi karma means there is no beginning to our situation. It can have an end, but it has no beginning. Why? Because material energy has no beginning and we have no beginning. So naturally, the relationship between us and the material nature has no beginning. That's how Shastra has explained it. That's it. And I'm seeing the face of you all now, as you can imagine. And I'm seeing suddenly most of you are very serious at this moment. Because also it's a topic that in one sense goes beyond our heads. No, that how can you think about something that has no beginning? I mean, you are without beginning. No, we as souls have no beginning, but we cannot think eternity. Right? Eternity means something that has no beginning and no end. We as Atma have no beginning and no end, but you cannot think about something which has no beginning or no end. Our thinking spectrum can only conceive things that have a beginning and an end. So if suddenly I tell you, try to think about something which had no beginning, I will start to see smoke coming from your ears very, very quickly. Because it's another layer, it's another dimension that we can access not by thinking. And that's why sometimes some of our acharyas have say different things about this particular topic, have say no things whatsoever, or has, yeah, with language, with words, trying to say something that goes beyond thought. You follow my point? I mean, just to think about something that has no beginning is beyond, not only, it's beyond thought. What to speak of words? No. In one sense, words are more limited than thought, if you want to put it that way. So if something's beyond thought, what can you say in words about that? So different acharyas have tried to say different things, which in some cases may sound contradictory. Sometimes we have heard, we have fallen from Golok Vrindavan, we have fallen from Vaikuntha, nobody falls from Vaikuntha, we have fallen from Brahman, Brahma Jyoti, there is no fall whatsoever, anadi karma, long list of ways of trying to explain this thing. but again, in one sense, all of those things fall short, because there are still, and I'm not criticizing any of the people who and the personalities who say all those things, I'm just saying, those are words, and we receive those words and we try to think about them, but all of this lies beyond thinking capacity. So in that sense, I always like to go to things, to Bhaktivinoda Thakur, he will say, try to go deep into your practice, try to access eternity through your practice. And once you do that, you will understand what we're trying to tell you through words over here, something like that. So there is a point that we can speak about it, and I'm talking about it, and I have talked about it. But there is a point where we should learn to stop talking about it and entering another layer and resorting to a different means of accessing reality, so to say, rather than thinking. I'm not canceling thinking, as you know. I'm not someone who is just stop thinking, just pressing the achintya button. No, if you ask me something that is very difficult, I will say achintya, inconceivable. Next question. No. Now let's think as much as we can. We have a thinking capacity. Let's have critical thinking. Let's exhaust those assets we have till they collapse, so to say. Now let's use them as much as we can till they start to collapse and show their limits to us, and then we know, okay, whatever is beyond this cannot be accessed through this stuff that I have between my two ears. So I have to resort to a transrational means of knowing by prayer, by surrender, by opening my heart, and all the things that have to do with eternity, with things which have no beginning or which have no end, depending on the case. Ultimately, they will be understood not here, not in our head, but in our deeper self by realization, by practice. So that's what I can say, Martina. No, because again, following my conviction of anadi karma, you can say, okay, we have turned away from Krishna. But when that started, since time without beginning, we have turned away from Krishna. I will present that grammatically in that sense. For us, maybe that sounds, but it seems like it began at one point. For me, it didn't begin at any point. But anyhow, at one point, And I've gone through different stages internally about this. And I've heard it a few times about this telling, well, at the end of the day, it doesn't matter so much how did all that begin, but where we are now and where we are heading toward. And I remember at some point I was like, I felt, and I still feel, that can be in one sense a lazy way of avoiding the whole conversation. But also there is a place to say that after you have confronted the conversation in detail. And I'm not saying I have confronted the conversation in full detail, but I've spent some time with that particular issue in my life. And at present, I don't know tomorrow, but today I'm at the place where, for me, in one sense, it doesn't matter that much which opinion anyone has in that connection, but where we are now and how we are conceiving in from now onwards. But of course, again, if you ask me, I'll bring my arguments to the table, so to say, and I will mention why for me it doesn't make sense that anyone can fall from the spiritual world, because that creates lots of problems. If you think everyone can fall from the realm of, what can make you fall from there, right? I mean, if you say falling from there, what makes you fall? You generally will say Maya, the gunas, but there's no Maya, no gunas there. So what can make you fall from there? So the turning away from God, the Bahir Mukhyata, as Jiva Goswami will say, which like looking in another direction, according to Shastra, again, this is not my own conclusion or concoction, is happening from an adi time, which means time without beginning. Different acharyas may have said different things. I cannot tell you why they say that at each given moment. I don't know which was the context, the person they had in front. Like I mentioned many times, Srila Prabhupada, in some sections, he says, you fell from Vaikuntha. In some other section, he says, nobody falls from Vaikuntha. You have to do what to do. Okay. And if you ask me, like, why Prabhupada did that, I don't know. I cannot tell you why he did that. I was not there next to him asking him why you did that, Prabhupada. I don't know. But what I can try to do is try to study rich, which is what's the Siddhanta given in Shastra, and then try to think as best as I can why he or anyone else may have said something different at times. That's kind of the exercise I tried to do in my first book, in the second part of my first book, in relationship to the topic of Bhakti in the Jiva, related topic. But trying to think why maybe they have said that, probably because of this, probably because of that, but I cannot be conclusive. I'm not there to tell you why. I'm trying to make my best effort to understand this topic. As Shastra explains it, as much as I can be loyal to that, I can try to make my best to understand why other acharyas may have said something that apparently contradicts that. And then I can try to make my best effort to go deeper into prayer and sadhana to access the living reality which lies beyond thoughts and words. And all these themes, in one sense, are beyond thoughts and words. And sometimes, and I'm not saying that's your case, Martina, but that's for my case for sure, sometimes we became too tempted to remain in the words and thoughts platform as a way to not enter deeply and fully into the realm of experiential prayer and opening, where those things will be revealed. So we also, again, have to know when to put a stop to the mouth, to the head, and when to let go and swim deeply into the world of prayer and surrender and chanting and sadhana, trusting that whatever we cannot figure out now will be eventually revealed. No? And have patience. No? We cannot just like demand understanding like as soon as possible. Some things will be revealed in time. Like I was talking with two devotees in France these days, and one of them told me, like, yeah, my Gurudev gave me an instruction first time I met him, and now after whatever 30 years, I think I'm starting to understand it. For 30 years, I didn't know what he meant by that. And now it's starting to make sense. And some other devotee telling me something very similar. He said, like, I'm starting to feel that I'm working on integrating certain things, but it may take like 20, 30 years for me to be at the place of proper integration. So I was like, yeah, great. I appreciate your willingness to go through that process. And some things need that time, which is nothing in comparison with eternity. No, so that's what I can say today. Martin, I hope it helps.
Yeah, it's very helpful, actually, especially the first part of your answer. It really touched me, and it was very nourishing. So okay. Thank you so much.
Oh, please. Thank you for your question. And we are past hour and a half. I think we can put the conversation to rest here, if it's okay, Yugal Kishore. If you had any question, maybe next Saturday. We keep pushing, but that's the reason to keep... good reason to continue to meet with each other. So thank you so much to all of you for your friendship, your sangha, your association, your presence, your attention. All of them are gifts to me and blessings to me. So please, as we began talking about, we need more grace than with what we think. All your presence here and your attention and questions and everything is part of that grace that I didn't know I needed. And now I'm becoming aware of that. So thank you for helping me to become aware of how thirsty I am and needy I am for grace. And hopefully see you next Saturday, same time, same channel, from Switzerland this time. So thank you so much. Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu ki jai, Sri Harinam Prabhu ki jai, Sri Sri Gaur Nityananda Gaur Gadadhar ju ki jai, Sri Sri Radha Madan Mohan Radha Govinda Dev Radha Gopinath ju ki jai, Gaur Bhakta Vrinda ki jai, Gaur Priman Hari, Pancha Kalpa Tarubhyascha Kripa Sindhubhyaiva Cha.